It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We are 12 days, just 12 days to go before the Iowa caucuses on February 1st. It's Politics Wednesday, and our guests on this show, Kedron Bardwell, Associate Professor and Department Chair of Political Science at Simpson College in Indianola, joining us by phone. Hello, Kedron.
Hi, good to be with you, Ben.
Great to have you with us. Hans Hassel with us, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Hans, always great to have you on the program.
It's great to be here.
I am so eager to get your insights from the two of you as this race gets more exciting, more interesting politically by the day. And we want to reach out to our listeners as well this hour. Perhaps you are still undecided about the candidate you will caucus for in 12 days. What are you weighing that will help you decide who gets your support? Join our conversation with the answer to those questions if they apply to you or other questions having to do with this race, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Yesterday, Iowa Governor Terry Branstad said he would like to see Texas Republican Ted Cruz defeated in Iowa. Now, he was speaking to reporters at the Iowa Renewable Fuel Summit in Altoona. He said Iowans would be making a big mistake in supporting Cruz, and because he is a staunch opponent of the renewable fuel standard. Here's some of what he had to say.
He is the biggest opponent of renewable fuels, and he actually introduced a bill in 2013 to immediately eliminate the renewable fuel standard. He is heavily financed by big oil. So we think that once Iowans realize that fact, they might find other things about him attractive, but I think it would be very damaging to our state, and that's the reason why he hasn't been invited to this, because he hasn't supported renewable fuels, and I believe that would be a big mistake for Iowa to support him. And I know he's ahead in the polls, but the only poll that counts is the one they take on caucus night.
Okay, and here's Senator Ted Cruz of Texas responding to the governor's statement.
Well, look, it is no surprise that the establishment is in full panic mode. We said from the beginning that the Washington cartel was going to panic more and more. As conservatives unite behind our campaign, you're going to see the Washington cartel firing every shot they can, every cannon they can, because the Washington cartel lives on cronyism. It lives on making deals. It lives on picking winners and losers and is supporting corporate welfare and cronyism. This is what people are so fed up with. It's how we've gotten an $18 trillion national debt. And so it's not surprising, and we're going to see even more of that, because every day what we're seeing on the ground is the grassroots are making their decision. They're coming together. Conservatives are uniting behind our campaign. And we will see, like the Empire Strikes Back, the establishment will strike back, because they don't want an end to the cronyism and the gravy train from Washington.
Okay, in 60 seconds, Washington cartel and cronyism, I think three or four times in there. Kedron Bardwell, Ted Cruz says he's not surprised. Are you surprised that the governor, after refusing to come down on the side or endorse any candidate, he makes a statement like this?
I actually was a little bit surprised. He had said that he would essentially not endorse, and I guess this isn't an endorsement, but it's an anti-endorsement. So whether it affects the race, I'm not sure. I think it's more of a wash. You've seen Cruz already, as you said, trying to emphasize the anti-establishment part of his campaign, and he uses that against Branstad, I think, fairly effectively. Yet he's been hit by the renewable fuels issue a few times already the last few weeks, and I think it could do some potentially small damage to Cruz. But overall, if you think of this in the larger scheme of things, it's really amazing that the Republican Party is essentially in its own primary running against itself. This is really dividing the Republican Party into factions, and I'm not sure that that's a good thing moving into a general election.
Hans Hassel, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think Kendra's correct on a couple of things there, and what I found really interesting is the two different explanations of this that you see, right? You see Branstad's explanation of this being about renewable fuels. You see Cruz's explanation of this as being establishment versus outsider candidate rhetoric, right? The Branstad is essentially using the renewable fuels as a way to insert himself into this establishment anti-establishment debate within the Republican Party. I'm not sure I agree necessarily with Kendrin here about this divisiveness causing problems for Republicans. I mean, there was a lot of talk about in 2008 about between Clinton and Obama, how that campaign would hurt the eventual general election nominee, and I'm not sure that it actually did. And previous research has suggested that when you're not dealing with an incumbent, competitive primaries are actually very helpful because they provide information to voters and they get that information out there. Now, if you're dealing with an incumbent, that's bad because it's a signal that the incumbent has problems within their own base. But I think that a healthy competition among Republicans is not necessarily a bad sign of things to come in the general election.
Mm-hmm. Kedra, let me go back to you. Have we ever seen this sort of division at this stage, heading toward a general election in a Republican primary? What does it say about the Republican Party at this point, where it's headed?
Well, we have in past elections seen some candidates. We had in 1980 a candidate essentially leave the Republican Party and run as an independent, John Anderson. So we have seen that wasn't quite as fractious a debate as I think this one is. The reason that I think this is problematic for Republicans going forward is it's not just kind of the Cruz anti-establishment wing versus the establishment wing. It's the addition of a third person and a third person running explicitly against the party, and that's Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think when you've essentially divided the Republican Party into three factions that are now legitimately, if you look at the negative campaigning we've seen just in the last couple of weeks, trying to destroy the candidates of the other side, I think it's certainly possible Republicans could pull things together during the summer in the convention and make nice and find a way to support each other in the fall. But I think it's also likely you'll have a few voters sitting out, and who knows what happens if Trump doesn't win the nomination. You may see him or someone else try to make a third-party run.
As an outsider, too, Trump also leading in the polls. Kedron, your thoughts, why wouldn't Branstad take aim at Trump as well?
You know, I can't speak to Branstad's internal motivation or how he's thinking strategically on that. I don't imagine he's a fan of Trump at all. But I think there's a view among a lot of people in politics, and I'd include not just pundits and establishment Republicans, but scholars as well, that just eventually Trump's going to fall on his own weight, that something will happen and people will wake up and realize that this is not presidential material. This isn't someone that you would actually want in control of the nuclear codes. But, you know, so far that hasn't happened. And Trump's found ways to find new voters and not rely on the old Republican primary base or coalition. And so he may end up bringing a lot of new voters into the process. Now, if those voters are not pleased with the outcome of the race, say Trump doesn't get the nomination, the question is, what happens to those voters? Do they sit home? Most of them are disaffected in the first place, so that might be a likely option, or do they go somewhere else?
Continuing on the GOP side before we go to the Democrats, Hans, what are we seeing in terms of momentum? If you would say one GOP candidate has momentum right now, regardless of where they are in the polls, do you see any happening?
Well, I think that what we should be looking for is who's going to come in third here, because I think that plays a big role into subsequent primaries. And so I think that you could say, right, that if Trump or Cruz will win, what happens in that third spot? Is that Rubio? Is that some other establishment candidate? Right? Who is that person that comes in third and that can use that as a rallying point to say, look, I'm the best option among the establishment candidates. We need to jettison these others and really focus our attacks so that we can take down Cruz and Trump. And so I think that looking at who comes in third, and right now Rubio's run a very good campaign so far, coming into the caucuses in a couple weeks. Jeb Bush, I wouldn't count him out with what you have left. I think it's important to remember that if you look at 2004 with about this much time left, John Kerry was 10 points down in the polls. In Iowa, and so to say that that someone is out just because they're so far down right now, I don't think that a lot can change in the last week and a half.
Hans Hassel with us of Hans Hassel with us of Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Kedron Bardwell of Simpson College in Indianola. It's Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, and if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to leave your comment or your question. They're calling it Ted's terrible, no good, very bad day yesterday. another chapter in that book. Sarah Palin, the politician turned reality TV star, offered a passionate endorsement of Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump, who happens to be a reality TV star turned politician. Sarah Palin, of course, the former Alaskan governor who was Republican Senator John McCain's running mate in the 2008 election. Let's hear a little bit about what she had to say in endorsing Donald Trump yesterday.
He is from the private sector, not a politician. Can I get a hallelujah? Where in the private sector you actually have to balance budgets in order to prioritize to keep the main thing the main thing. And he knows the main thing a president is to keep us safe economically and militarily. He knows the main thing, and he knows how to lead the charge. So troops, hang in there, because help's on the way, because he, better than anyone, isn't he known for being able to command fire? Are you ready for a commander-in-chief? You ready for a commander-in-chief who will let our warriors do their job and go kick ISIS ass? Ready for someone who will secure our borders, to secure our jobs, and to secure our homes?
Sarah Palin coming into the fore here on center stage with Donald Trump in the background, absolutely beaming. Kedron Bardwell, can she attract additional support for Trump?
I don't know. That's a mixed bag for me. I've talked to conservatives here, conservatives elsewhere. Some of them have kind of seen Palin as jumping the shark a few years ago when she went off and did a reality TV show, and then has made money since then with some minor network television talk shows. What was really interesting about that for me is, you know, what are the McCain people thinking at this point? You know, you have the vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, under John McCain, who's essentially endorsed a candidate that said that the POW McCain is not a war hero because he was captured. You know, it's a story that you almost couldn't write. It's surreal. If you had written this story a couple years ago and ran it to people as a script, they'd say, well, that's preposterous. That doesn't work. That's never going to happen. So it just tells you about the moment in politics that this level of disaffectedness among the public with government and with Washington, D.C. It tells you that essentially this is a conduit for that. People are just wanting to express their antipathy toward D.C. in whatever way possible, even with, I think, as we look at Trump and Palin, they're flawed messengers for that specific message.
Mm-hmm. Both have this blunt rhetoric, folksy rhetoric, plain-speaking style as a hallmark of their appeal. Hans, I wonder, how much do they overlap? How much is a Trump supporter likely to also to be or have been a follower of Sarah Palin?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think they have a very similar appeal in their blunt style of rhetoric and how they communicate with supporters. I think that this is I think that among kind of the mainstream media and those that are not within the conservative movement, we've kind of put Sarah Palin off to the side and said, this is a show, right? This is a circus, just in the same way that we put Trump off to the side and said, hey, this is a circus. And I think that by doing that, we don't necessarily realize what sort of appeal she has to a certain segment of the population, a certain segment of the voting population specifically. She is still very popular, I think, among a certain segment that is very conservative, Tea Party type individual. And I think that this is actually reinforces Trump's appeal to that segment of the population. I think this is essentially saying, look, this is someone else that we supported back in 2008 and thought was a great, wonderful addition to the to the ticket. She's come out in support of someone that we view as important, and someone that was very influential in getting Ted Cruz elected. And so I think that, right, this is a signal to some of those individuals that, hey, this is a real candidate.
Could you imagine a Trump-Palin ticket, Hans?
Well, I think that usually presidential candidates want to get someone who balances them in some way, and I'm not sure that Palin would do that for Trump. But that said, Trump has surprised a lot of us,
right,
in the way that he's run his campaign many times. And maybe this would be a perfect selection.
What do you think about that question, Kedron?
Yeah, I agree with Hans. I think it's unlikely. As it gets more serious, let's say Trump does win the nomination, he's going to be struggling with two things. One, bringing back a party that has fractured over the course of the nomination process. But number two, selling himself as electable to a larger, much larger segment of the U.S. population than he's having to deal with now in these narrow primaries. And so, I would expect not a conventional choice, but a more conventional choice from Trump in terms of maybe trying to shore up his weaknesses in policy or foreign affairs.
Well, certainly not what the Republican Party expected a year ago when, if we remember, Jeb Bush was laying out plans to blow out his rivals by raising record sums of money, which he did. Rand Paul was to be considered the outsider, and the idea that Donald Trump might enter the race, not to speak of dominating the race, was still something that was laughed off just a year ago. And now look at the race. We have, according to the most recent Des Moines Register, Quinnipiac polls, the most closest competitors to Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, running behind, though, in double digits. Time Magazine calling it Ted's Terrible Tuesday, another slam, another chapter for the Texas senator here in our news of the last few days. A new lawsuit claiming Ted Cruz is ineligible to run for president, citing his Canadian birth. Case lodged Thursday last week by a Texas attorney, Newton Schwartz, says Cruz is ineligible to run as he isn't a natural-born citizen. That is the phrase in our Constitution. Cruz was born in Canada to an American citizen. Schwartz says in his complaint, this 229-year question has never been pled and presented or finally decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. He has requested the Supreme Court expedite the case ahead of the Iowa caucuses. Kedron, how big of a problem is this for Cruz?
Well, I think it all depends on a couple of things. Number one, it certainly would be useful for the courts to get on board and actually resolve this issue so in the future we don't have to deal with these questions. We've dealt with them in the past before with accusations against people like John McCain. So it would be good to have a little more legal precedence to rely on so we don't have to have this fight again. But as I look at the Iowa race and even going forward in the other states, remember that these are races that can hinge on just a few thousand votes. So you're thinking maybe a small margin, and in the case of the last Republican nomination in the race in Iowa, it was just a couple dozen votes. So any small movement that you can get to peel away supporters from another candidate could be helpful. And what Trump is just trying to do here is sow a few seeds of doubt among those people that see Cruz as someone who can win the nomination in a general election, a few seeds of doubt that he might be under legal cloud while he tries to do so.
Of course, this birther launch by Donald Trump, we had birther claims dogging President Obama for years. Also the instigator of that, Donald Trump. Hans, how is this different? How is this different and how is it playing out differently? There we have a birth certificate of our present president from Hawaii establishing. He was forced to release the full form of that, even though he has had a mother from Kansas.
Yeah, I think this is different. One is that they're alleging that this individual was not a U.S. citizen, that he was born outside of the United States. And I think they're even quite. I mean, if you look at Obama's the conspiracy theories about Obama, it's not just that he didn't have that he wasn't born outside of the United States, that he wasn't born to American parents, so that the mother he claims was not actually his mother. So it's bigger than this. But this question is not new, right? This is something we addressed with John McCain back in 2008. I mean, this goes back to George Romney running in 1968 for president when George Romney was born in Mexico, right? So this is a question that comes up again and again. And I think the general consensus is that this isn't a problem, right? We've seen Republicans nominate somebody before with the same birth location outside of the United States. We've seen other candidates run for president without as much commotion about this. And I think that the problem is that we've never actually had an official legal ruling about it, even though it seems as though the general legal consensus is that this is just fine. The natural born citizen means being born to citizen parents. And that's what Cruz's situation is. That's what Obama's situation is. Obama goes even further and was born in the United States. That's what George Romney's situation was, born to American parents outside of the United States because his parents were living outside of the United States at the time. And so I don't think this is a good distraction, a good ploy to gather some media attention, but this really I don't think is a big issue.
Okay, we want to switch over to the Democratic side in just a moment. We have a couple minutes before we take a break. Let's get an opening volley from you, Kedron. We have the last Democratic debate. We'll hear some excerpts from that. That took place on Sunday. But Bernie Sanders, neck and neck with Hillary Clinton here in Iowa. How much of a deja vu are you seeing with compared to 2008?
I think there are obviously some similarities that people would point to in terms of having a progressive senator making a charge from the left to try to reclaim certain segments of the electorate, bring in younger voters, bring in new voters. So I don't think, you know, the Hillary Clinton camp should be surprised by this. But I think, at least judging on that last debate, they found some ways to meet the challenge of Sanders well. You saw her attacking Bernie Sanders on issues of gun control, on issues of how he would actually implement some of his health care proposals. And one of the things that I've noticed that the Clinton camp seems to be taking advantage of is just the detailed level of her policy positions and the fact that she tends to have very comprehensive plans for each of these issues, not just to be able to speak about them in debates, but even on her website, I noticed she has a full white paper on autism research. I mean, this campaign is really doing its homework in terms of trying to lay the groundwork that they're the ones who are actually ready day one to go in and start making some changes to the system.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back with Kedron Bardwell of Simpson College in Indianola, Hans Hassel of Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Politics Wednesday, 12 days out from the caucuses. Hey, calling all you political junkies, and we know you're listening. If you're listening to this hour, you can join me and the Gazette for an evening discussion on the caucus campaign in Iowa's future as the first in the nation decider here. Pints and Politics at CSPS in Cedar Rapids tomorrow evening. I'll be there at 5 o'clock. Space is very limited, but you can hear a rebroadcast of that event on Friday at noon here on River to River. That's Thursday night, tomorrow night at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, a political event. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll go further into the last Democratic debate, play you some excerpts on gun legislation comments, also Obamacare and Wall Street. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Kedron Bardwell, Associate Professor and Department Chair of the Political Science Department in Indianola's Simpson College. We'd like to have you join our discussion as we are just a dozen days away from the Iowa caucuses. Are you planning to go out to a caucus either for the Republicans or the Democrats? Are you still undecided about the candidate you will caucus for? What are you weighing that will decide who gets your support? 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A good deal of the first half hour we spent talking about developments on the Republican side of the race. Let's concentrate more on the Democratic side. We had a fourth and final debate ahead of the Iowa caucuses Sunday night when presidential candidates faced off in Charleston, South Carolina, to talk about Wall Street, health care, gun law. The debate was hosted by NBC News, moderated by Lester Holt and Andrea Mitchell. This debate had 15.3 million viewers. That made it the highest-rated Democratic primary matchup in TV history. Now let's go into some of these issues. On the issue of guns, Secretary Clinton was called Senator Sanders has called Senator Sanders a pretty reliable vote for the gun lobby. And here is Senator Sanders' response.
Well, I think Secretary Clinton knows that what she says is very disingenuous. I have a D-minus voting record from the NRA. I was in 1988. There were three candidates running for Congress in the state of Vermont. I stood up to the gun lobby and came out and maintained the position that in this country, we should not be selling military-style assault weapons. I have supported from day one an instant background check to make certain that people who should not have guns do not have guns. And that includes people with criminal backgrounds, people who are mentally unstable. I support what President Obama is doing in terms of trying to close the gun show loopholes, and I think it should be a federal crime if people act as straw men.
Okay, Kedren Bardwell, what do you think in the debate about the topic of gun legislation here between Sanders and Clinton?
Well, obviously, with the shootings we've had, prominent shootings, including school shootings over the last several years, this is an issue that's important to many Americans and is particularly resonant within the Democratic primary electorate. And so I think Clinton overplays her hand a little bit when she says he's been a reliable vote for the NRA. But certainly Sanders' record is mixed on some of these questions. And if you dig back into some of the votes that she's discussing related to Brady Bill and other issues, it's what we're seeing is somewhat the danger of being a senator, which is that oftentimes there's various versions of proposals and counterproposals that are offered at the times of these votes and the passage of major legislation. And she's picked apart pretty well some of the alternatives that Bernie Sanders had supported. Now, he says, you know, today he's a reliable vote for gun control, but she is able to pick at some of those specific votes in the 1990s to try to poke some holes in his record. Mm-hmm.
Hans, I wonder, is gun control, gun legislation, something where Clinton can peel back some support, regain some support from people who perhaps went to Sanders? Is gun legislation the tool? It seems to be one of her only tools.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking here to right, each candidate wants to frame the debate of issues in a way that benefits them. And I think that if you look at Democratic voters or Democratic individuals' little caucus with the Democratic Party in a week and a half, the majority of them have strong opinions about gun control. And so they're going to be focused on – and so she says, well, let's frame this debate between Sanders and myself as a debate about gun control, right? This is something that we are different enough on that perhaps I can really make a key difference here and try to highlight those differences between me in a way that will favor the Clinton campaign over the Sanders campaign among that segment of voters. Sanders is trying to do the same thing as well, right? His focus is on aspects of income inequality and education and the differences between the Clinton campaign's view on regulation of financial services. Right? There are key differences between them, but each of these differences benefit an individual candidate. Right? Part of this is creating a line of cleavage between the two candidates that favors your particular candidacy.
I think, you know, this is another instance.
We want to get to the cut, obviously, Clinton there in just a moment. We jumped the gun a little bit on that, but let's talk a little bit about one of the other topics of the Democratic debate on Sunday, health care, Obamacare, as it's commonly known. When asked about their plans for health care, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders went back and forth over plans to build on or to reform the Affordable Care Act.
We have the Affordable Care Act. That is one of the greatest accomplishments of President Obama, of the Democratic Party, and of our country. And we have already seen 19 million Americans get insurance. We have seen the end of pre-existing conditions keeping people from getting insurance. We have seen women no longer paying more for our insurance than men. And we have seen young people up to the age of 26 being able to stay on their parents' policy. There are things we can do to improve it, but to tear it up and start over again, pushing our country back into that kind of a contentious debate, I think is the wrong direction.
I have to talk about something that's actually working in our state.
No one is tearing this up. We're going to go forward. But what the secretary neglected to mention, not just the 29 million still have no health insurance, that even more are underinsured with huge copayments and deductibles. Tell me why we are spending almost three times more than the British, who guarantee health care to all of their people. 50% more than the French, more than the Canadians. The vision from FDR and Harry Truman was health care for all people as a right in a cost-effective way. We're not going to tear up the Affordable Care Act. I helped write it. But we are going to move on top of that to a Medicare for all system.
Andrea.
Okay, heated exchange there on Sunday night between Clinton and Sanders. Hans Hassel, let me go back to you and ask, what did you hear in this debate? This is an interesting one. The Democratic base really believes in a single-payer system, and it puts the position Clinton in the position of arguing against it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. This is exactly what I was talking about, right? That you have both campaigns have issues that they would like to frame the campaign around. Because by framing it around those particular issues, you resonate with voters that are going to be showing up at caucuses or in Democratic primaries, right? So Clinton wants to make this about guns, right? Because she views her position on guns as more favorable among the certain segments of the population that are going to turn out to vote in Democratic primaries. Sanders, on the other hand, views the issue of healthcare, a single-payer system, as much more favorable to his campaign. And so it's these issues that the campaigns are trying to play up in a way that will benefit them and give them a leg up among voters.
Mm-hmm. Do you see, Kedron, Bernie Sanders getting traction here over Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, I'm not sure how this one plays out. I mean, it's really surprising in a way because Clinton is essentially framing her position on this healthcare issue as a more conservative and cautious position, and then trying to frame the fact that Bernie wants Medicare for all as something that's dangerous or radical or that would cause people's healthcare to actually decline. So, I was just a little bit surprised in terms of the way she framed that. Now, healthcare is a very important right to people, and it can be at certain times of life when you have emergencies, you absolutely need to depend on it. And so I think what she's doing in playing this strategy is trying to get people to think that Bernie will actually tear it up, that in fact that Obamacare will go away and there'll be some period of uncertainty and then we'll have whatever system replaces it. But that's not usually the way things happen. You know, if this system, Medicare for all or any larger reform happens, there'll be a transition period and we'll have the coverage we already have in that transition.
Can I?
Yes, Hans, go ahead.
An interesting perspective, because I think that when I listen to that, I hear, right, she's talking about this issue in a way that she's trying to take it off the table. She's saying, we've done so much, we've accomplished so much here, right? Obamacare has essentially solved this problem. So there's still something which we need to talk about, but it's not a big issue. And so you shouldn't think about it in terms of determining who you're going to vote for, because it's not critical. It's not going to kill us, so to speak. Right? This is not an issue that we need to focus on right now. What we need to focus on is other things. And so I think that while she recognizes that it's important, she's trying to say this is not as important as some of these other issues that are more important. And those are the issues that you really should make this decision about who to vote for on.
About 10 minutes left with Hans Hassel of Cornell College and Kedron Bardwell of Simpson College, our political analysts on this edition of River to River, Politics Wednesday, reaching out to you to ask if you're still undecided. Here's a response to the query from before on our Facebook page. Emily from Cedar Rapids says, I will be caucusing undecided on the Democratic side. Bernie's plans sound great, and I would be on board, but I don't know how practical it is that these ideas would actually be implemented, writes Emily. He wants to go above and beyond the job description of the president, but maybe too far, therefore becoming impractical. Hillary seems to be the most practical choice, especially when the going gets tough. She can make the impossible decisions the president confronts. She would carry out the creations of President Obama, which I believe is necessary. Plus, having a female president would be incredibly empowering. On the other hand, America does need change, and Hillary does not it would not be the drastic change that America needs. There we have Emily there, undecided in the Democratic aisle. Kedron, you see that. So this is interesting. The Iowa caucuses, especially on the Democratic side, very fluid. People show up undecided. People show up for one camp and then can switch camps if their camp doesn't get viability. This shows us the caucuses are a living, breathing thing on the night it happens.
Yeah, you've got the movement of the camps and undecideds can move, and then people have discussed a lot the idea that the O'Malley vote may not reach the 15% threshold in many precincts, and so those people will have to move over to another group in the second round. One of the things, as you mentioned Emily's statement, one of the things I was thinking of is the Iowa caucuses are so early in the process. I think as you move later into the primaries, people start to think a lot more about electability and pragmatism. But there's the opportunity for the Iowa caucus, and it's shown itself this way in past elections, which is that you can use the caucus vote to make a statement or to have a voice about a specific issue. And so obviously there's a number of people supporting Bernie that really do support him and want to be president. I think there's probably some number of Bernie supporters that also are just wanting to say, you know, don't forget income inequality. Don't forget the progressive wing of your party. And so they're able to have the luxury to do that because Iowa goes early enough that as the course of the campaign conducts itself, the candidates can actually adjust and take on some of the positions on the issues that voters have made a statement about in the first couple of races.
Let's talk to Tom in Des Moines. Tom dialed 1-866-780-9100 and I believe watched the Democratic debate on Sunday night. Is that right, Tom?
Yes, that's correct. I think health care is a very important issue, and that's because the Affordable Care Act, which should have been named the Accessible Care Act, because it was made to increase accessibility and not affordability, which is something the law's constructors really recognize. If you read Stephen Brill's book on America's Bitter Pill, you know that. It needs to be, healthcare needs to be important because we need to attack the issue of affordability. Affordability has not been really addressed by the lawmakers of Obamacare, so if Hillary's saying,
yeah,
then we need to do something. We don't need to do anything else. She's wrong, but I still think we need to go in the direction of, taking care of the problems of Obamacare.
Uh-huh. So if you're caucusing with the Democrats, Tom, is this a deciding factor based on the argument there they had about the Affordable Care Act and health care, the future of it in this country?
No, not in itself. It's an important issue, though. And I think that what's going to decide it is whether a candidate has a holistic vision for America, not just, you know, attacking things on certain political points and trying to press my emotional buttons. I think that's not going to happen.
Right.
I have a master's degree in history, and I understand how politicians work. And they're not going to manipulate me into voting for them. So I'm looking for a holistic vision from each of the candidates to determine whom I'm going to vote for.
Tom in Des Moines, thank you so much. Nora from Mason City called to say that she's annoyed by how the media is dismissing O'Malley. We haven't mentioned him, so let's do that right now. He was a part, I think, time-wise, he got half of what either Sanders or Clinton got on it. Hans, what kind of player is O'Malley still at this point? He's polling still in the single digits and was perhaps going to be excluded from this debate, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a tough situation where you've gotten the other two candidates have essentially locked up a large swath of the Democratic Party's voters, and I'm not sure that he has a clear path towards the nomination here. I think that he got into the race hoping that something would happen, that Hillary would implode, and that somehow he would kind of ride into the nomination when no one else agreed to run. But that hasn't happened, right? I think he occupies much of the same space, ideological space, that Hillary Clinton does, and she's just such a dominant figure in that ideological space that it's harder for him to get any traction at all. And so I think that he can be influential in the process, in that he can shape the debate about the issues. And you have seen some of the issues that he views as important come up because he's raised them. And I think that may be his biggest impact on the race, is that he's changing, or he's shaping in some ways the issues that are talked about.
Coming to the final few minutes with Hans Hassel and Kendren Bartwell on this Politics Wednesday. At the beginning of the hour, we talked about, led off with the story of Governor Branstad speaking out and saying, it would be a very big problem if the caucuses were won by Ted Cruz of Texas because of his stand on the renewable fuel standard. And Jim is on the line from Adair County. Jim, you have a view on this as well.
Yeah. You guys talked about the political aspects of it, but I viewed it more as an economic issue. A lot of people in this state have worked quite diligently, including the governor, on developing the ethanol industry, and I kind of took it as the governor didn't want to see that, you know, jeopardized in any way, and that he felt it was maybe time to make sure that people were aware of the stance that Ted Cruz took on ethanol. And I guess I viewed it more in economic terms. Mm-hmm. You know, ethanol is very important to our state, and especially the rural areas. But even in the metro, is, you know, the trickle-down effect that ethanol has brought in the last 10 years is fairly substantial.
Right.
And I guess when I kind of applauded it. Typically, he stays out of the political, saying things about political candidates, but I think he just, from an economic standpoint, probably felt compelled to make sure that everybody understood where that candidate stood.
Jim, if I can ask, if you're going out to caucus for the Republicans, is that a deciding issue for you?
It is one of the issues. It's maybe not the deciding one, but it's fairly heavy. I'm quite involved in agriculture.
Okay. Jim, thank you very much from Adair County for calling in. Let's go to Eric. Eric in Dallas County, Dallas Center. Eric, I don't think you're there anymore. You're definitely not there. Let's listen to one little more piece from the Democratic debate. Senator Sanders here calling out Secretary Clinton for, in his words, getting personal speaking fees from Goldman Sachs and the Obama administration for taking money from big banks. Here's Clinton's response to Sanders' attack on that.
There should be no bank too big to fail and no individual too powerful to jail. We agree on that. But where we disagree is the comments that Senator Sanders has made that don't just affect me, I can take that, but he's criticized President Obama for taking donations from Wall Street. And President Obama has led our country out of the Great Recession. Senator Sanders called him weak, disappointing. He even in 2011 publicly sought someone to run in a primary against President Obama. Now, I personally believe that President Obama's work to push through the Dodd-Frank bill, and then to sign it, was one of the most important regulatory schemes we've had since the 1930s. So I'm going to defend Dodd-Frank, and I'm going to defend President Obama for taking on Wall Street, taking on the financial industry, and getting results.
Okay, Hillary Clinton on Sunday night. Hans Hassel, a big embrace, several embraces for President Obama by Hillary Clinton there. Even though he's a president with approval ratings of less than 50%, it's to her advantage?
Oh, yeah. Again, that 50% is among all Americans. If you look at the Democrats, it's obviously much, much higher. We live in a very polarized time. And so even though maybe some people would like to see more regulation, more members of the Democratic Party would like to see more regulation. This embrace of President Obama, right, diffusing the situation by pointing to someone that Democratic voters really respect and admire, I think is a very good way of addressing that problem. Go ahead.
Very little time left. Let me go to each of you very quickly. What questions are in your mind leading up to caucus day in 12 days? Kedron, very quickly.
Well, I think just the fact that as we look at caucuses past, there's been very late movement, even within the last 10 days. And so it's certainly possible that in the next week you could have a rise of one candidate, a fall of another, and that this would affect the momentum and then the springboard that candidates get out of Iowa. So it's not over till it's over,
okay.
And the national polls don't necessarily predict.
Hans Hassel, very quickly.
Looking to see who comes in third and who can consolidate the establishment vote among the Republican Party.
Okay, thank you very much, Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Kedron Bardwell, associate professor, department chair of political science at Simpson College in Indianola. Kedron and Hans, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.